And welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, July 28th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio today from the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online is Cindy McCormick. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning.
And joining us a little later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling calling in from the Nantucket Inquirer-Mirror. We'll hear from Ann Wood joining us from the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and Island. Cindy, let's start with a report out this week. Took a close look at contaminants found in public water supplies. It included information about the Cape region. You covered this story.
Yeah, this was the Environmental Working Group. It's their tap water database that was released on Wednesday. Anyone can go in and plug in their zip code on the database, and they'll find the public water supplies near their area and how they fared, according to their report. Because what they did was they just took a lot of reports, analyzed them, looked at what was in the water, and they found contaminants everywhere, basically, you know, contaminants in public water supplies across the Cape and across the nation. They actually looked at 50,000 public water systems.
It was a huge scope to do the entire nation, but then you can go in and you can plug in your zip code and see what contaminants they found in your local water supply.
Right, right. So, for instance, and within the town of Barnesville, there was, like, arsenic in the water and perfluorinated chemicals. And one of the things is that they say that they're taking a much stricter view than the Environmental Protection Agency and even the State Department of Environmental Protection, which in some cases can be stricter than the DEP, because they said the EPA has not actually added any new chemicals to its list of regulated contaminants in 2 decades. And that's a long time, because a lot of new chemicals have been coming along. And there's been a lot of emerging science about, you know, how these can harm you, you know, hurt your thyroid system, you know, possibly be linked to cancer, you know, be endocrine disruptors, and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating that the government hasn't, or the federal guidelines haven't been revised as recently as that. In the 10 years, you say they haven't added any new contaminants to that. And that, well, this study in particular was looking at levels that are what would be considered maybe unhealthful, but necessarily don't cross the federal guideline thresholds.
Right, right. They said that most of the public water supplies, you know, pass the federal and their state regulations, that wasn't the issue. The issue is all these emerging contaminants and what's in your water, and a lot of them are basically unregulated. And they say that the Environmental Working Group says not only are these government regulations out of date with emerging science, but sometimes, like, adding things to the list is a political process. Laurel Shader, she's from Silent Spring Institute, and she's a researcher there studying environmental links to breast cancer in the Cape, says that says that they look at things like whether you can actually, you know, fix this problem in your water supply. And then, like, that's factored in. And she said that people might be surprised to learn it's not just based on health, but whether public utilities have the technology to actually fix this problem.
And if they don't have the technology, then maybe they're not identifying that as something that needs to be addressed immediately by the water supply department.
Right. But the water companies did supply this information to the agencies, and so a lot of them are testing for them. They're just, nothing's being done about it at this point. You know, of course, the perfluorinated chemicals in Hyannis are doing, a lot is being done about that.
Yes, well, we hear a lot about the water supply here on the Cape with the single source aquifer.
Right, right. It's a precious source.
Let's move on to the Pilgrim Nuclear Plant in Plymouth. Two workers were cited for entering the plant improperly.
Yeah, well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission did an investigation through its Office of Investigations, and they say the two men were cutting corners, not planning mayhem. Now, this doesn't fly with everybody. Pilgrim opponent Diane Turco, she's president of Cape Downwinders, criticized the nuclear power plant for routinely taking shortcuts. She said this is just part of a pattern. And she told the Times, it's easier to get it to Pilgrim than into an elementary school.
Well, it's a good line, but the fact is that the plant has been cited for so many violations over the last couple of years. I mean, now it's been downgraded to Category 4, which is the worst level before that has a mandatory closing.
Yeah, it's one of the worst performing plants. And this incident happened in March of 2016, and it's called tailgating. And what happened was one of two workers had forgotten a security badge, and that's to be worn on the plant grounds and help secure access to off-limit areas where only authorized personnel is allowed. And the employee who had the ID passed it through an ID machine at the access area and had his hand scanned to authenticate his identity. That released the turnstile. But after entering through the turnstile, he slid his card and scanned his hand and again and manually spun the turnstile so it created the illusion he had left the area. And then using his badge and hand scan, he repeated the process to unlock the turnstile to allow this fellow employee who had forgotten his badge to enter. Now, that he could have entered by going to, like, security, basically. You know what I mean? There could have been other ways of doing this besides kind of cheating your way into the plant.
But it sounded like he was afraid that he would be marked as late for work, and that would have been against him. And so he had his...
But ironically, a consultant from Synergy Consulting Services, and this is a group that does independent safety culture assessments at nuclear facilities, was waiting at the gate to get into the secure area at that time, saw the incident and reported it. Although this the consultant who witnessed the witness violation told investigators he was not even interviewed by security personnel after reporting the incident. And that's according to a report provided to the Times under the Freedom of Information Act.
So the consultant was there to do a safety inspection, and he saw this thing happen right in front of him. It's unbelievable. And then I guess the concern is not – I mean, they sounded like the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station was sort of trying to downplay the severity of this incident, saying it was a minor type of violation, right?
Well, even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is saying, well, you know, this wasn't done out of malice. This wasn't done to create a problem. But what opponents are saying is, okay – but what if it were done to create a problem? This is lax. This is not proper authorization. How easy is it to do this? And the Patrick O'Brien, who's spokesman for Pilgrim's owner, Entergy, said changes have been made regarding site access, and the employee without a badge left to take a job elsewhere, according to the report from the Office of Investigations.
And the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station is scheduled to be shut down still in 1919. So
2019.
Yeah, 2019. I'm sorry. 2019. It's still early in the morning for me. 2019, of course. And so this is just part of what I guess they call a poor safety culture is what it's being called.
And opponents like to see it shut down before then. You know what I mean? They'd like to see it. Yeah.
We're going to turn now to Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Hiya, Sarah.
Good morning. Hi.
Sarah, I understand that there is a surprising development, you might say, among the island law enforcement community. This is a fun story. Tell us about
this. Yeah, very surprising, very cute development in Oak Bluffs. And so over in Oak Bluffs at the police department there, we have Baby Lark, who was born in March. Then Gunnar arrived in May, followed by Lowen in June and William in July, and Baby Julian just last week. So that's five babies in 5 months. And this is for four officers at the Oak Bluffs Police Department and one former Oak Bluffs police officer who's now a state trooper assigned to the barracks in Oak Bluffs. So five babies and five dads in the police and law enforcement up there. And, of course, you know, this is a coincidence and the stars aligned, though there's been lots of jokes about something in the water in Oak Bluffs at the police department. But you know, it's really a function of having a lot of officers who are kind of the same age. They're their late 20s, early to mid-30s, in the kind of the same life stage. And apparently this kind of happens in cycles sometimes. The current police chief said, you know, about 10 years ago when he was having his kids, there were a couple other officers who were having kids about that time, too. And now, you know, they've kind of grown up together. Now there's this new wave of police officers who are starting their families. So we got them together this week for a photo. So we had the five officers and their families and their little newborns, including one who's just over a week old, which was really fun. And it also kind of showed, you know, that obviously there's a lot of, you know, these officers work together. There's a lot of camaraderie that way. But now they have this other thing in common, too, which is that they're all dads and relatively new dads, that the families are kind of, you know, they have someone, people that they can talk to about things like diaper technique or whatever's happening. Even during the photo shoot, they're kind of like sharing advice about, oh, you know, maybe move the baby over here out of the sun. So there's kind of this this cohort of people that can be friends. And they also said, you know, maybe they anticipate going to birthday parties, each other's birthday parties, and hoping that maybe these little ones are friends, too, as they're growing up together. So it's kind of a fun, kind of a really fun thing, and a very cute photo of the officers and their babies.
A very sweet photo there in the Vineyard Gazette. Five babies born in 5 months to the police department.
That's the baby boom.
The baby boom. Great story. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Yep, you too.
Bye.
Cindy, the Governor's Council on Aging held a local meeting this week in which seniors and advocates addressed a wide range of issues.
This is one of four listening sessions being held across the state. It was the third, and the last one will be in Pittsfield on Wednesday. It was quite well attended. There were more than 100 people attending this session, and the two biggest issues were housing and transportation. And then advocates for the seniors and the seniors themselves talked about how lack of housing and transportation and social isolation can lead to anxiety and depression. In fact, Melissa Weidman of Hope Health called them the social determinants of health.
I was struck by the many different issues that sort of all come together, converge on this discussion, including rising property taxes, how that affects seniors, right, and the aging homeless population.
Yes. Karen Reddy from St. Joseph's House in Hyannis, that's formerly the NOAA shelter, said they're increasingly dealing with homeless seniors, and this is natural because the population is aging in general. And she said that they have served 89 people from age 55 and older between November 2016, when they took over the functioning of the shelter, and June 30th.
That's a number of people for sure.
Yeah, and she said that they have special needs. They have many more medical issues, and so they're finding ways to meet those needs. And she also feels that people of a certain age shouldn't be in shelter. It's just too rough an experience for them.
You can understand why that would be. Also, there's an issue with aging veterans. Just a whole host of issues that go along with this discussion.
Right, a man who's active in the Joe Gentile, who's active in Veterans Affair organization. Spoke about the needs of veterans and veterans not being able to afford nursing homes and just their needs also for housing as they age.
Well, this is not going away for sure. And the Governor's Council on Aging having a meeting here to try to figure out some strategies to address this.
Right. And they said there'll be a report by the end of the year.
And moving on, in Dennis, a church has proposed a change to its signage. Seems fairly innocuous on the surface, but it's run into some difficulty.
Yes, well, the Village Improvement Society voted in June to reject a church sign advertising the Dennis Union Church's acceptance of the LGBTQ community. But now the church and the Village Improvement Society are trying to kind of get together and reach some agreement on the sign wordage and symbols. So what it says currently is all are welcome. But last month, the church sought approval from the Dennis Old Kings Highway Historic District Committee to change to an open and affirming congregation and add a rainbow banner, which is a symbol of the LGBTQ community. But the Historic District gave the okay, but they said, you're also going to need the approval from the Village Society, because that sign is on the Dennis Village Green, not church property. But then the society voted 6-5 against the changes to the sign, with one abstention.
And did they have any understanding why the society voted against the changes to the sign?
They're not really speaking. A reporter tried to reach different members of society without much luck. Lois Andre, who's the chairwoman of the Board of Trustees of the Dennis Union Church, said she and other church members are in ongoing discussions with the Village Improvement Society. And she said the two groups have had great relations in the past, and they're grateful that they're allowed to have their sign on the Dennis Village Green. And this would not be a change in the size of the sign. The size would stay the same.
It's a relatively small sign, is what it looks like there.
Right, and this is part of a certification that the Dennis Church got from the United Church of Christ. The United Church of Christ began giving churches the open and affirming designation 31 years ago, and now almost 1,500 churches hold that title. And they say that they just want to make sure that people feel welcome, know that they are a welcoming community for the LGBTQ community. As well as everyone else too.
And so now they're continuing to work on this, and with the group that is asking them not to do it yet.
Right. Well, what Lois Andre says, they are in ongoing discussions, but we don't know what those discussions consist of. The people from the Village Improvement Society are not talking to our reporters, so it's kind of going on, behind closed doors. And it's a small community, so perhaps they will be able to work this out pretty shortly.
Okay, we will keep an eye on that. You are listening to the Point News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We'll have more in just a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And joining us on the phone is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, seems like it wouldn't be a news roundup without a shark story. It's not art sharks this week, but the real deal.
Indeed, the program to tag sharks off the Cape's East Coast is going full bore at this point. So far this season, Dr. Greg Skomel and his colleagues from the Division of Marine Fisheries and the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy have tagged, I believe, 6 great white sharks, and that's pretty much on par for what they've been doing the last 3 seasons. But what's unusual this year is that several of those sharks already had tags on them. Skomel had previously tagged these sharks with acoustic tags, which register on receiver buoys deployed all along the coast. But now 3 of those sharks have a second tag, thanks to a collaboration with the University of New England in Biddeford, Maine. Those sharks now have short-term satellite tags on, as well as the acoustic tags. Skomel says these tags are programmed to pop off the sharks in about a month. And at that point, they'll download to a satellite very detailed information about their movement, how deep they go, water temperature, that type of data. And combined with the acoustic tags, the data they get on the movement of the sharks, locations and such, that will produce a very detailed picture of the shark's movement patterns and their behavior in our waters. Now, Skomel says that's important because right now researchers really only observe the sharks in the daytime. They just get, pings if the sharks happen to swim by one of the receiver buoys. They don't know where the sharks go at night. They don't know how often they're in shallow areas, scouting out seals or whatever. These tags came from Dr. James Sulikowski up in Maine. And he provided a total of 15 of the short-term satellite tags. Now, he's interested. He's been working with Skomel for a while, and he's interested in information about female sharks and what sort of condition they're in when they're present on the Cape, if they're pregnant. And he's also provided Skomel with a specially made a dart, which Skomel will be able to use to take a tissue sample of the sharks that he tags. And that tissue sample can be analyzed for all sorts of information, from hormone levels to genetics, et cetera. And Skomel said this is really going to help them ramp up the detail that they're getting for their population study. So we'll be watching in about a month when those satellite tags pop off, and we'll get more information about where our local sharks are going at all times of the day and night.
It'll be fascinating to see what that data reveals.
Sure, especially when, people, they don't see the sharks very often. One of the things Skomel said was that they don't see that many predation events, considering the amount of sharks and seals that are in the area. So they're interested in finding out if they could track those with this information. So it's going to really be interesting to find out where they go from there.
Tim, Chronicle has another story about police investigating the destruction of trees on the town-owned golf course. Tell us about this.
Yeah, indeed. Town officials recently discovered that a handful of mature trees bordering the town-owned Seaside Links golf course have been girdled. And girdling involves cutting through the bark around the entire circumference of a tree. In this case, it was done with a chainsaw. That exposes the tissue beneath, and arborists say it's almost always fatal. And in this case, officials say that the damage was obviously deliberate, and they say it was made worse by the spraying of herbicides into those girdle areas, which really put the nail in the coffin, so to speak. Now, this occurred near the golf course 8th Green, near a location where there's been a recent dispute with a homeowner over golf balls being hit into his property. Now, officials stress that they don't have any evidence this time implicating anybody in this vandalism. They're at this point trying to reach out to anybody who might have information about it. They're trying to find out also the cost of replacing these mature oaks to find out what sort of charges they would bring if they are indeed able to get any evidence. Police are asking anybody with any information on the situation to call their anonymous tip line, which is 508-945-8847.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
Yep. Cindy, in Falmouth, an effort is underway to extend a connection to the very popular bike path.
Yeah, there's eventually the plans are to connect East and West Falmouth and the Shining Sea Bike Path. Now the Bikeways Committee has taken the first step, the first kind of baby step, by meeting with Selectmen Monday to discuss plans for a Trotting Park connector. That would be a path between Trotting Park Road in East Falmouth and Trotting Park Fields and Skate Park. This would be about an eighth of a mile across town old land and cost about $70,000 to $100,000, which they hope will come from community preservation funds.
Now, the committee heard from a lot of people in support of this idea, I gather.
Yes. Well, currently, bicyclists take this roundabout and somewhat dangerous route when they're going from East Falmouth and heading to Trotting Park Fields, both pedestrians and bicyclists. The current route goes up Trotting Park Road, across Brookhelm, and down Gifford Street. Now, there are more than 5,000 vehicles on Brookhelm daily and more than 9,000 on Gifford. Scott Lindell, who's chairman of the Bikeways Committee, said, as a cyclist, none of those roads are attractive.
The proposal for this is going to go across town land.
Right.
The connector.
But just like an eighth of a mile across town land.
And the selectmen are going to take up this issue now?
This will be brought before them in a meeting Monday. So this is like the first little baby step with this project. And then ultimately the plan is connect East and West Falmouth, a Shining Sea Bike Path, and just make and people say they'll make the roads less congested too. Mm-hmm. Will not only improve bicyclist safety, it'll make the roads less congested, but vehicles won't be there'll be more people on bicycles as one of the plans and make it safer for the bicyclists. The State Department of Transportation says that between 2010 and 2012, there were 43 reported crashes in Falmouth involving bicycles.
So getting those bicycles off the road and onto the bike path seems like the right way to go with this.
Yeah, I don't know if you bicycle, but the Cape Roads have so many places have no shoulders whatsoever.
Yes, yes. The bike path is so popular. It's wonderful to see that it could be expanding a little bit further.
Right.
We are going to go to Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, let me start off by, well, you start off, Josh. What do you have there?
Well, the big story this week is the impact that Uber and Lyft and the ride-sharing transportation companies are having on Nantucket's taxicab industry, which has long been the primary source of transportation for people on Nantucket, both visitors and residents who didn't have cars or didn't have access to cars. And these disruptive technologies, as they're being called, is really putting a dent in the cab driver's business, they've been telling us, for most of the summer. Obviously, Uber and Lyft have been around for a while now, kind of working their way east from the West Coast, but never really an issue on Nantucket until this summer, the cab drivers say. Some say that their business is down 20 to 40% because of the ride share, and they understand, they say, the competition, and competition's good. It's American, but they feel they're not playing on the same playing field. They say that the costs are different, background checks are different, and they're very concerned about it.
Josh, in another technology kind of related story here, I understand that there's a big data initiative looking to gather publicly available data into one place.
There is. The town of Nantucket, basically a $100 million corporation when you factor in the town budget and all the capital projects that are going on. And a number of town officials in recent years say they struggle to make important decisions without having access to the most recent and updated information and data, primarily about the island's population, demographics, and statistics. They're out there. They're not sure whether they're updated or not. And this new initiative called the Nantucket Data Platform would consolidate publicly available information in one place, on a cloud-based operating system that would allow not only town officials, but nonprofits, businesses as well, access to this information to allow them to make better decisions. It's a process that's being used primarily in some larger cities around the country, but also in smaller communities. It's called smart community or smart city decision making. Town hoping to do this. It's right now it's a private corporation, a private company, an LLC, that's hoping to put this together. They're seeking funding. They already have one customer in the Remain Nantucket nonprofit group that's funding a study of what they're calling the island's effective population, which would be the number of people that are on Nantucket at any given time, since it fluctuates so much given the seasonality of a resort destination like Nantucket. That's really going to be the baseline, and then moving forward, hopefully this information will be available to town officials, the public, and nonprofits as well.
Hmm. And speed limits, people are taking another look at speed limits on the island?
They are something a little closer to perhaps many people's daily lives. There are a lot of 20-mile-an-hour speed limit signs around on the island, but as town officials and the police department have been telling people for a while, state law in Massachusetts does not allow for 20-mile-an-hour speed limits on the vast majority of streets and roads. It's actually 30, and there was a new state law that went into effect a few years ago that towns could adopt that could lower that to 25, and that's exactly what Nantucket has done. So anywhere that is what's called thickly settled, whether it's a dense business district or a residential area, the town of Nantucket is going to a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit in an attempt to slow down traffic. Fortunately, this hasn't been driven by any big accident, a fatality, or anything like that, but really by a desire among town officials and law enforcement, public safety, to slow traffic down, make sure they're aware of the fact that these are busy areas, especially in the summertime, and that they should drive accordingly.
And is there a general consensus that that's moving in the right direction?
There seems to be. Obviously, I think once this gets publicized a little bit more, there will probably be some grousing. But in the large majority of these areas, it would probably be difficult in the summer to drive much more than 25 anyway, just given the number of cars on the street, the number of people and bicycles. But the law is in effect now, and police department said that once the public information is out there, they'll probably give some warnings, some written and verbal warnings, and then they'll start issuing tickets for violations, within a month or so if they catch anybody.
Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks for joining us this morning, Josh.
Thank you.
Cindy, there's a committee that's overseeing the Herring River Restoration Project. This is a massive project, and the committee itself is seeing some shuffling among its board members.
Yes, well, Dennis Murphy, he's chairman of the Wellfleet Board of Selectmen. He's also an appointed member of the Herring River Executive Council. Now, this council is governing this restoration project, as you mentioned. It's, 1,100 acres project in Wellfleet and South Charles, and that's to remove an old dike that was set up and blocking the flow of water. It's supposed to increase flushing and improve the ecology of the area. But Dennis Murphy has found that this could possibly increase the value of his land, including his primary residence and 3 acres that he now mows, because that could be changed to a waterfront area with the rising tides.
Mm-hmm.
So he consulted with his attorney and then decided, he heard some rumblings, and he consulted with his attorney and said, he wanted to avoid even the appearance of a conflict of interest. So he resigned, and then on Tuesday night, the Wellfleet Board of Selectmen voted to replace him with board. Well, he hasn't resigned yet. He plans to resign at the next council meeting. And Tuesday night, the Wellfleet Board of Selectmen voted to replace him with board vice chairwoman Janet Reinhart.
When we say this is a massive project, this is a $50 million project, and it's really only the first phase of which that they're looking at right now.
Yeah, this is just the first phase, and not everybody's property will benefit from the increased tidal flushing these higher tides, because some people's land will be underwater, and not everybody has been notified yet of what part of their land or a structure will be underwater. So far, about 7 property owners have been identified as having structures that could be flooded in the project's first phase. One of them is the family homestead of Rebecca Rosenberg on Way 672, and that would need to be totally vacated because of its low elevation. Currently, negotiations are underway with a house exchange with the Cape Cod National Seashore. And another property to be affected is the Chequesset Yacht and Country Club. Mm-hmm. And the club signed an agreement in May that will allow higher tidal water onto the golf course in exchange for $5 million in government money to elevate some golf holes and also to pay for operation losses during construction.
And I guess Dennis Murphy, who is the chairman of the Wellfleet Board of Selectmen, he was stepping down just to avoid the appearance of having any conflict of interest.
Right, right.
It wasn't
Right, he heard some rumblings. I mean, and he's saying, it could happen. The property value of his land, could be increased. There's another council member, a woman who's been looking into it, and she hasn't resigned. She can't determine whether or not her land value would be increased. Apparently, there'd be one small lot that would be completely flooded, so there would just be marshland, wetlands, and some real estate agents have said they can't really tell, yet what would happen to the value of her land.
And again, the intention of this project is to restore that whole ecosystem to something like what it was before a dike was built back in the early 1900s.
Yeah, it was in 1909 that a dike was constructed at the mouth of the river, and the removal will just allow a lot more flow, a much larger flow of water in and out, which they consider much more healthy ecological flushing of the area and restore the native habitat and be better all around.
Very good. We are going to turn to Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner. Ann, are you there?
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Hi, Ann. And we're beginning to see plans for Provincetown 400, the anniversary celebration of the Pilgrim's Landing, coming up in 2020. But questions, I guess, continue about how prepared the town may be for this.
Well, vaguely. We're a little bit worried about the town being prepared for the Pilgrim's 400th anniversary of landing here in Provincetown. We were waiting and excitedly waiting for Lisa Giuffre, who's the Provincetown 400 executive director, to meet with the Board of Selectmen for the first time since she was hired in September 2016. She did that on Monday night, and she talked a lot, fast, quickly, and for 45 minutes gave a presentation, but it was mostly conceptual. She said, we're really actually at where Provincetown 400, where Plymouth 400 is in plans, and we're in great position, but we looked into Plymouth 400, and it has a comprehensive website that includes events that are happening now, as well as 2020 signature events. There's a bunch of them going on in Plymouth, including like Indigenous History Conferences, an Embarkation Festival, Illuminate Thanksgiving, Unity Day, Wampanoag History Exhibit, on and on and on. And Giuffre, on Monday, though, touted a short list of events for us, but two of them, at least, are Plymouth, which is Unity Day, which is happening in Provincetown, in which she said we are hosting, and then the Provincetown to Plymouth Regatta and Parade of Lights. So those are actually Plymouth-organized events. But she also said that Provincetown 400's program is coming along with various other committees, but nothing's really been solidified. She said she's working with the Pilgrim Monument and Provincetown Museum, the executive director David Widener there, and that they're going to sign a memorandum of understanding. But Widener told me that nothing's been signed yet, but of course they're going to work cooperatively with to create programming for the 400 because it is the Pilgrim Monument. She also said that she's working on plans to engage with the Provincetown International Film Festival in June 2018. But the executive director of the film festival, Christine Walker, said we have no specific plans that she knows of. And Giuffre also said that she's joined forces with Jay Critchley, an artist in town, to develop an idea of having modern-day people writing modern-day Mayflower compacts throughout the area, state, country, and maybe internationally. And those compacts or words from them would be written on prayer ribbons that would tour nationally, which is something Critchley already does with memorial ribbons. Critchley said that he's in conversation and that it's a project they're working on, but they haven't signed any agreements. So the only real date she gave was on January 6, 2020, at the Bas Relief. If it's renovated, she's going to have an opening party with entertainment and a time capsule there. And then there's the Voyage Festival from September 19th to November 16th, 2020, to honor 66 days the Pilgrim sailed on the Mayflower. Now, Selectman Chair Cheryl Andrews was a little bit taken aback by the fact that it sounds like the festivities for 2020 are going to end on November 16th, 2020, because the Mayflower was still here until December 18th. That's when it left for Plymouth. And in fact, in November 20th, a baby boy was born here in Provincetown, and Andrew said, darn it all, I expect a baby day. So hopefully we'll have more concrete plans coming forward. Giuffre says that'll happen probably in late September or October. So we're looking forward to that again.
And the Province Lands Bicycle Trail celebrates an anniversary, huh?
Right. Everybody should get on their bikes right now, because right now until 11 o'clock, it's actually happening at the Provincetown Visitor Center in Provincetown. It's a big celebration, the 50th anniversary of the Provincetown Bicycle Trail, which I didn't realize was the first bike trail developed in a national park. Dr. Paul Dudley White, who was President Dwight Eisenhower's personal physician, actually dedicated the trail on September 17, 1967. And White was one of the first doctors who nationally promoted exercise to prevent heart disease and then to improve heart health. So that should be pretty exciting. There's rangers down there now, Girl Scouts with cookies for free that you can eat, and bicycle safety checks and displays, and people are riding on this 5.25-mile-long trail, which goes through dunes and the shady beach forest and has extensions that add up to about 2 miles to seashore beaches. So it should be a lot of fun.
And they've got a fine morning for that celebration.
It's perfect. It is the perfect day to ride a bike out on the seashore.
Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner. Ann, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And you are listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We'll have more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And joining us right now on the phone is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. And good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, George.
George, a popular swimming spot for children in Menemsha has been closed now for a little while, and some people are not happy about that. They're looking to get it reopened.
That's right. This is Crab Corner in Menemsha. And listeners might remember that back in June, there were some kids on a field trip. They were in the water at Crab Corner. They felt little electric shocks, and they were taken out of the water. And since then, there's been this ongoing investigation into what caused those shocks in the water. They've done a lot of electrical work at this transient dock where a lot of yachts come in and plug in. And, you know, they feel like they have those under control, but the selectmen in Chilmark are taking a cautious approach, and they're not allowing kids to go back and use Crab Corner. Well, there are some parents who are upset about that because this is a place that folks have used for generations, and they want it back open. They've started a petition drive. So far, selectmen are saying, no, we're not going to reopen this. But they are doing a little bit more investigation over the next couple of weeks. They're going to check the water to see if there's any electrical charge in the water and, you know, maybe perhaps make a decision after that to reopen. So right now, still closed and taking the cautious approach.
And I guess there was some concern, too, about the nearness of boats to that Crab Corner.
Right. I mean, that's there are regulations that boats can't go near a swimming area. And so this is sort of a chicken and egg thing. What came first? Did people use Crab Corner as a swimming area or wading area, or was the transient dock there first? You know, and that may be something that plays itself out in this controversy as well.
Hmm. You have another story in which it looks like the spirit of innovation continues among the island's local food efforts. You now have a mobile farmer's market truck. This is really nice story.
This is really cool. This is the Island Grown Initiative, and they got a grant from the Department of Agriculture to launch this program. We have a lot of farmers markets on the island, and but you know, there's not always a lot of access to them because, you know, though there is some public transportation, you know, getting to the farmers market isn't always easy. And so this one comes to you, and 3 days a week, the mobile farmers market launches, and they go to various areas around the island. And even though it's open to everyone, they also have programs where they'll accept EBT cards and WIC cards and senior cards, which actually lower the price of their produce and fresh fruit, making it accessible to low-income people as well. So not only are they taking their fruits and vegetables on the road, but they're also making it accessible to people who might not find fresh fruits and vegetables accessible.
It's a great, ambitious project, and it also looks great, I have to say. The pictures on your website, the illustrations on the truck, it's kind of decorated with vegetables and fruit and pictures of fish.
Yeah, I would say our photographer, Stacy, did a fabulous job capturing the essence of this mobile food market.
George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve, and have a good weekend.
You too. Cindy, on Martha's Vineyard, questions are continuing over the firing of the CEO at the hospital. It was very abrupt, appeared to happen without any reason given. Now some island citizens have created a group to press the board for more information on this.
Yes, it's called Concerned Citizens, and they say that they want two-way communication, better communication between the hospital board and the community. Now, the full board of trustees of Martha's Vineyard Hospital is scheduled to meet today, and trustees who attended a meeting on July 15th with Concerned Citizens say that they promise they will bring the issues and concerns to the full board. And one of the things was, you know, as you mentioned, that Joe Wooden was, you know, terminated unexpectedly. He left June 5th, and the way his departure was handled, it actually even led to more controversy. So Wooden was on the job for just over a year.
Just a year, yeah.
Yeah. And the Martha's Vineyard Hospital issued a statement saying, they issued a statement to hospital staff saying that Wooden was, in quotes, stepping down. Now, this came from Martha's Vineyard Hospital, where Rachel Vanderhoop is the head of marketing. She happens to be the wife of Tim Sweet, who is chairman of the Board of Trustees. So that raised some eyebrows, too, the way it was handled. And then even those eyes got very wide when Wooden said he was asked to leave and not given a reason for his dismissal. So, and that continues to be an ongoing controversy. And people want to know, you know, how did this happen? What can we do to prevent something like this from happening in the future? Oh, and by the way, what is your relationship with Massachusetts General Hospital? How much clout do they have in these decisions? Mm-hmm. Because they're affiliated through a membership in Partners Healthcare. And they also want to review, they also want the board to review hospital governance policies and just make sure that things are more transparent and that their actions are more transparent and better communicated to the public.
And what happens now? Who's in charge now?
Well, the former Martha's Vineyard Hospital CEO, Timothy Walsh, he retired last year, and he's back. He's back at the helm while they start a search for a new CEO. And Joe Wooden is still on the island, and he had moved there from Vermont, so he'd really, you know, uprooted himself and his life to be part of the island community. And now this Concerned Citizens group says they are interested in keeping, you know, they don't want to be seen as an adversary to the hospital in any way, shape, or form. It's a great asset to the community, and they just want to make sure that that it's got a great connection to the community.
Let's turn to the next story here, and the Cape Playhouse. Some good news for the Cape Playhouse, which has been under some scrutiny lately. Tell us about this.
Yeah, they've raised the Cape Playhouse has raised nearly $200,000 in the past few weeks, and this is part of a push to fix both the building and its financial situation, which has been described as pretty bleak. The Board of Trustees has been criticized in recent years for lack of fundraising, despite deteriorating structures and debt. And I don't know if you've been to a place there. It's a very charming old
building. Amazing old theater, yes.
Right, very quirky, but apparently in great need of repair. So. And last week, the Playhouse was awarded $25,000 in a budget signed by Governor Charlie Baker. It also raised $60,000 through its benefit gala earlier in the month. And they are also raising money from matching grants from the Massachusetts Cultural Council and Cape Air founder and CEO Dan Wolf. So it seems to be on the track to raising this money that we'll need to make the repairs. And some of the money that is going to be shared with some of the state money is going to be shared with the with the Cape Cod Museum of Art, which is right next door, and it needs a new roof.
And they are also planning some new initiatives, it sounds like. They're going to be pairing with the Cape Wellness for the Cape Cod Women's Music Festival, perhaps?
Well, yeah, they want to build these community ties and support in the community. And so Playhouse leaders this week announced they will partner again next year with the Cape Cod Women's Festival. And these funds, the state monies were pursued by State Representative Timothy Wayland, a Republican from Brewster, and he said it's important to advance cultural tourism on Cape Cod. This is what, you know, attracts people to the Cape. This is not just the beaches. It's a Cape's very unique culture. The Cape Playhouse is now in its 91st season. It was built as the Dennis Unitarian Meeting House in 1838 and moved to its current location in 1927. It did get a new roof in 2015, but there have been few other major renovations and repairs in recent years.
It's 91st season. That is an institution.
Yeah. Imagine the ghosts treading those floorboards, you know.
And amazing the names of the people who have performed past. In a story that seems to be developing still, a young man has been charged in a series of nautical thefts. This seems to be not about the money, but about